this thing start. So I'm Jamison Lopp. I'm an infrastructure engineer at CASA, or I have been for a couple of weeks now. Spent the past 3 years as an infrastructure engineer at BitGo. One thing that these two services have in common is that they're both non-custodial, multi-sig solutions. BitGo being a 2 of 3, and CASA being a 3 of 5. And so I've been in the Bitcoin space for 6 or 7 years. I've been doing it full time for 3 years with various non-custodial solutions. And it's pretty easy for me to pick up new Bitcoin hardware and software and start using it. But really what I'm trying to get at this talk is that we need to be designing this software for newbies if we really want to grow the ecosystem and bring it to a mainstream audience. And it's a lot easier, in my opinion, to do that as a custodian. But if we really want to fulfill the promise of Bitcoin so that the average person can be their own bank, we've got a lot more challenges ahead of us. So I've been in the trenches for a number of years now. I've seen some crazy stuff. I've seen users lose money in more ways than I could ever imagine. In fact, I've seen people turn multi-sig wallets into what are effectively single-sig wallets. I've seen users get frustrated by inconvenient security policies, turn them off, and subsequently lose millions of dollars. I've met countless individuals who choose to leave their crypto assets with a custodian because they don't trust themselves to use a hardware wallet correctly. In fact, I was just talking to someone in the lunch break earlier who told me that they knew an engineer who had been in the Bitcoin space for 7 or 8 years and had lost their money so many times that they're actually, you know, keeping it with a trusted family member just at their house. And now this person, you know, does not want to try to go through all of the trouble of securing their own assets because they've seen highly technical people lose their money so often. So Bitcoin itself has a really high learning curve. It can take years of operating in the space to actually pick up on some of the best practices. And I've seen newbies come into the space and they just, you know, treat it like a new API, a new platform. They don't actually understand all of the restrictions, all of the weird low-level rules that are going to prevent you from doing certain things on the network. So I've seen API users spam the network with dozens of transactions per second, even though it can only really support a few per second. I've seen people come in and just hard code their fees on transactions, knowing nothing about fee markets, and thus, of course, resulted in fees getting low fees and transactions getting stuck for a long period of time. And in fact, depending upon a user's transaction patterns, they're going to have completely different needs for how they do the UTXO selection and management of the data inside of their wallet. So you actually have this Goldilocks zone of UTXOs, you know, the real Bitcoins, if it were. And if you have too few or too many, then bad things start to happen. The wallet stops working in the way that you expect it to. And so we have
a number of different problems that people run into, and even something as simple as the balance, where you might look at your wallet balance and it might say you have 1 Bitcoin, but in fact, under the hood, you might have 10,000 different UTXOs with tiny little amounts of money, and it will cost you enough in fees that your real spendable balance is not 1 Bitcoin. And even if you have, for example, a lot of unconfirmed deposits into your wallet, you shouldn't really be counting those towards the balance either. So wallets that don't pick up on all these differentiators can in fact confuse users and make them think that they have, you know, different amount of value than they actually have. So it's very easy to achieve a high degree of security on your crypto assets. I advise people for the best security to just generate a private key, send your money to it, and then throw the private key away. That way, no one will ever be able to get to those Bitcoins. On the other hand, it's very easy to achieve a high degree of usability in a crypto wallet. All you have to do is create a web page. Just put the private key right there in the web page. Let anybody who wants to spend from that money, they have direct access to it. Very easy to use. So obviously, you know, we're trying to find some sort of sane equilibrium here. And the challenge I think that non-custodial wallets face is this root of trying to find the balance between security and ease of use. Because when we're building non-custodial wallets, we're giving up a lot of control of the wallet operation to the user because we want them to have a better and stronger security model. And once again, you're trying to fulfill the be-your-own-bank promise. The downside is that now the user has a ton of responsibility. And non-custodial wallet services are struggling with trying to help the users get over that high learning curve, trying to get them to understand all of the best practices, because we don't want them to shoot themselves in the foot. In fact, in an earlier talk, I think the BlockSide talk, he showed you that graph of all of the people over the years who have accidentally spent tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars on a transaction fee. It's a very, very simple misstep like that can be very costly. So looking at private key security, there's a lot of different trade-offs. If we're talking about single sig of non-custodial where the user has it, or custodial where some third party has it, there are many different types of malware that are out there that are trying to steal your keys off your devices. That's become a real big problem for users. Hacks, of course, always a big problem, though I would argue that they're a bigger problem for custodians because you're creating a honeypot. You're centralizing a lot of money in one location, so a hacker only really has to get into one hot wallet to get a much bigger payday. Weak passwords, of course, are a problem because not many people have software to handle their passwords for them. They just memorize a few passwords and use them. And the same password all over the place. End-of-life problems are really tough because you have to figure out both legal and technical implications of how to pass along those private keys. Data loss, bigger problem on users because very few people are really IT savvy. And in fact, the conversation I had earlier, you can be highly technical. You can understand how these systems work to a T, but still be lazy enough not to back up your data, and you end up losing it. So I recommend setting calendar events to actually check your wallets every now and then. Forgotten passwords, once again, a problem, mainly for people who don't use password managers. Coercion hasn't been a problem until recently. Now we're starting to see more kidnappings, thefts, actual physical, real-world violence being threatened against more public figures. And, of course, with the custodians, any number of things that could happen that cause, like, that company to cease operating that could, of course, result in you not being able to access their service. So when we try to use multi-sig, like I said, both BitGo, Casa, and other services, use multi-sig to try to get rid of a lot of these problems. And especially when you have like one key that's held by a security service that specializes in holding offline recovery data, that can help you with a number of these like end of life and data loss other problems. And really, we can get rid of almost all of them, except for the problem of the humans themselves. The weakest part of these non-custodial systems always ends up being the humans. And engineering against physical and social attacks is really an entirely different problem set. So when we're doing multi-sig wallets and we're spreading out keys over many different computers or hopefully even many different geographic offline locations, we can't completely get rid of coercion, but we can make it really, really hard because you'd have to travel all around the world potentially in order to get enough private key data to reconstitute and make a valid transaction. And so really, I say the biggest problem is, of course, phishing and scams of if a human has had their brain hacked to the point that they're like, yeah, I want to send some Bitcoin to this address because someone promised me something, then there's probably no level of technical sophistication that you can have that would prevent against that. Without getting too deep into the weeds now, like there's a number of just other things that go on under the hood. I kind of talked about how you're looking for a Goldilocks zone with UTXOs. When you're creating a new transaction, you want to be able to arrange the internal data of that transaction in a way that optimizes for certain things. And to my knowledge, the vast majority of Bitcoin wallets out there don't really offer flexibility around this and don't even ask the user what it is that they're trying to optimize for. A lot of them are probably very naive and are just selecting the oldest UTXOs or the UTXOs that result in the smallest number of inputs. But those can all have a number of different bad trade-offs that we've learned about more over the years as as we've ended up having like higher volume, larger wallets. I know there were some wallets that I saw over the years that actually had hundreds of thousands of UTXOs in them. This presents a very interesting selection problem because you, from a computer science perspective, can kind of consider this a bag problem of trying to find the knapsack like that has the exact specific best value match. And I will say that shout out to Mark Erhardt and his branch and bound algorithm, which he actually wrote his master's thesis on a few years ago. He implemented it at BitGo and then helped Andrew Chow actually get it into Bitcoin Core. That was nearly a year-long process. I think it just got merged a week or so ago. Other than UTXO stuff, there's transaction fee estimation. This is not a graph of transaction fee estimates. This is a graph of the divergence of transaction fee estimates between different estimators that are available. So like, there's not even really a lot of consensus around what the heck is going on with the fee market. So if you choose one fee estimator over another, you might end up paying a lot more. And really another thing is that users don't really, I think about the priority, like how fast do you really need something confirmed. It seems to me that most wallets are defaulting to like a two-block, you know, pretty high, fast confirmation. And that is actually going to result in larger swings, more contention for higher prices. And I think the bigger problem than that is that, of course, because defaults are a very strong thing in any piece of software, it's the developers that end up choosing these defaults. And we're not necessarily asking the user what it is that they want to get out of the wallet. As a result, I think we have developers that end up skewing the fee market in certain directions because they are making decisions on behalf of the user. And, of course, this applies to a number of things other than just fees. Another neat little metric here. This kind of shows you some of the heat map of cycles that happen in the fee market on a daily and weekly basis. And as far as I'm aware, there are no fee estimation algorithms that take any of this data into account. Most of them actually just look at trailing data, though we have a few that have started to look at the real-time mempool fee data. So, few users are security experts. We need to coach them and guide them into the right path for best practices. And you can do that, of course, by simple notifications in the UI or by actually enforcing different rules of how your software gets used. So the users, they're not going to read any documentation. I spent a lot of time over the years writing documentation. No one ever read it. Really, They're gonna use the software and just kind of fumble their way around through it. So you need to be proactive about what is required to use your software. If we're looking at stuff like password requirements, then if you make your password requirements insanely complex, that's pretty much gonna guarantee that it's gonna push them towards using some sort of password management solution. And also, we should not make any assumptions about the user themselves. Like, we should never have single-factor authentication, especially nothing around a phone. We've seen a lot of problems over the years, of course, with phone porting attacks, where if you're either doing any sort of account reset or 2FA through SMS, that is almost inevitably going to get compromised. And we really prefer using hardware 2FA for everything that you can. Same thing kind of around data management. One thing that I think is really interesting from the recovery seed perspective is that even if you have a hardware wallet, which is theoretically very safe, I think the securing of that recovery data itself becomes a real problem, mainly if your threat vector is like nation state level. So a lot of these hardware wallets will just give you a piece of paper and you write down your recovery seed on it and they'll say, oh, just put this in a safe place. But what is a safe place? I mean, you could put it in your house, but your house might burn down. You could put it in a bank, but the bank might end up having a rogue employee, or their employees might be coerced by some sort of nation-state actor due to some sort of investigation in which you may or may not be guilty, but it probably doesn't matter at the time. In fact, I think on Reddit we saw a story just yesterday about someone who had pretty much all of their assets confiscated. The only asset that ended up not being confiscated was their Bitcoin. So, key recovery services can also help out, with that data redundancy stuff. And I think that a lot of it, like I said, is just reminding the users. So one thing that I'm very happy about that we're doing at Casa is, in fact, instituting this idea of a health check, so that you're actually going to get regular reminders that you need to prove that you still have these various hardware devices. And if you don't prove every so often that you still have the device by signing a message with it, we're going to annoy the heck out of you, possibly even disable you from doing anything else with the wallet until you recover and replace those keys that you no longer prove you have access to. We also see some very interesting thing with the rise of all of these different forks. This actually was something that I saw, I think, in the Coinomi wallet, which I thought was actually very user-friendly because it at least lets people be aware. Whereas in the vast majority of wallets, they might just display a Bitcoin address to you or a Litecoin address or whatever, and not warn you that you might accidentally be sending some other crypto asset that will get stuck on that chain. Now, in a lot of these cases, this is technically not a total funds loss. It's usually just a major inconvenience. But of course, it is possible to lose money if you do something like send Bitcoin Cash to a SegWit address. That's going to be really hard to recover. Also, upgrading. Upgrading is great from a protocol standpoint if it's voluntary, but if we're talking about an application, it is a real pain. So while SegWit, it was great, it was a soft fork, it gave the rest of the ecosystem time to roll out, it was actually pretty rough at BitGo because we were trying to convince our customers, hey, we put all this time and resources into SegWit, and if you just spend a few minutes to upgrade your SDK, you're going to be saving a lot of money and helping the network scale and all this other stuff. But almost nobody did it. We would send emails, they would go without any response. And even with some of our larger customers, what we ended up having to do was run our own analysis that basically said, look, run this command and you'll save $70,000 a month. That is what finally got some people's attention because they were sending so many different transactions that they end up saving so much space, they save so much fees that you talk a lot about game theory and rationalization and stuff in this space, but I think that game theory is highly overrated because you make assumptions that like everybody has all of the information. But the reality is, people are busy running their businesses and living their lives. They're not paying attention to all of that. And then, of course, we come back to the user. The weakest point in any of these systems, there are some things that we can do. I was actually really happy at BitGo where we implemented what you could call a blacklist, but really all we did was we went out and we found the various malware, the clipboard malware that was swapping out addresses on people's computers and put all of those addresses into our database, and that has saved people, unfortunate novice users, tens of thousands of dollars by preventing them from sending money to a known scammer address. And user friendliness, this is once again just the problem of trying to get people to go in the right direction. This is, I think, a larger problem that if we think of this as like a multi-generational issue, users are experiencing culture shock, is that they're used to being able to call up a central administrator for their service to unlock their account, to fix any fraudulent activity, and we need to impress upon people that this is a system that rewards self-reliance and it punishes negligence and ignorance. And so I think that we can get best practices into the software by requiring it. Like, as more people are using more of these types of software that implement best practices and require them to be more responsible, hopefully that will start to result in a paradigm shift at a higher level. So I think I've got like 60 seconds left to kind of rant through that all. But if anyone wants to know about security in general or the challenges of running large enterprise software where the people are the biggest problem. Always hit me up afterwards too. Yeah. Just shout it.
Small UTXOs by age of the coins, and I didn't think that age had an effect on. But I'm curious.
Right. It doesn't anymore. It used to, but like the naive way of implementing UTXO selection is like a first in, first out type of thing. You can also naively implement it by just like looking for the largest value UTXO. Just spin that and create a change output. But you end up with really weird side effects from stuff like that that end up in a fracturing of your UTXO set into tiny and tinier and tinier little pieces until finally you get to an edge case that very few wallets can handle correctly, which is the sweeping edge case. Trying to sweep all of the value out of a wallet becomes a really big problem when your UTXO selection sucks and has resulted in you creating all of these dust outputs that in many cases cost more money to spend than they're worth.
Thank you.
Cool.